ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Brooke Nindorf with you, and welcome to The Country Hour today. Coming up, for the first time, an Australian Red will be up for auction at International Dairy Week.
They are the minority. We'd like to think that they're the third dairy breed in Australia. Holsteins are some 67-odd percent, I think, and Jerseys some 15 or 20%, and crossbreds account for quite a few as well. But then the Australian Reds come in just after that.
We'll hear why they're only just now being put up for auction at International Dairy Week. We'll hear more on that very shortly. But first today, ex-tropical cyclone Koji has torn through Queensland's north, dumping hundreds of millimetres of rain and sending water to inland communities. Queensland graziers say multiple rain gauges failed during major floods that have led to almost 50,000 cattle deaths. Premier David Crisafulli has called for more funding for rain gauges in Queensland, and Laura Lavelle has this report.
A lot of traumatised people. A lot of landowners have lost everything, all their cattle.
Found some our cows, one place over, jammed up the corner. Looking for the ones now, not looking for the hundreds.
We've just sort of resigned yourself to losing 1,000 head or more and then hope that by some miracle some of them survive.
The Queensland outback is underwater. 1.8 million hectares of land inundated. Stock losses are already in the tens of thousands and keep rising. A flood so large you can see it from space. From the air, the damage is obvious. But on the ground, knowing what's coming can be hard to predict.
There's no gauges, there's no warning to tell you that that's coming or going to happen. Like, it can happen in hours.
Grazier Ashley Gallagher is fed up with a persistent problem. Like many of its neighbours across the northwest, he relies on river gauges to know how much water is upstream, a critical tool when determining where and when to shift cattle during a flood. But this time, residents say many were offline or giving inaccurate readings.
So you're back to the old days, I guess, of ringing around stations to find out what's happening up the river instead of taking 5 minutes to look on the bomb page and see what's going on.
It cost him critical time as nearly a year's worth of rain fell in just days around Christmas. Thankfully, stock losses here are minimal so far.
Some of them didn't make it. Some of them are actually stranded on a little island because there's 4 big saltwater crocodiles sitting there waiting to take them. We actually tried to get them into the water and these crocodiles attacked the cattle as they went into the water.
The situation is dire on his second station, Yooralla. 1,300 cattle reduced to mere dozens.
We can all handle an ordinary flood and a couple of weeks cut off, but these are just unprecedented sort of flooding events and they just last forever.
...500 kilometres south in Richmond, graziers are also bracing for catastrophic losses.
That's some serious water coming up. We've never seen it do that before.
I've had those conversations where they said, no, they're all gone. I don't mean washed away. They've died in the paddock. It's a combination of everything. Cattle have died in the paddock from pneumonia and it's just from weariness.
More than 48,500 head. The estimated number of cattle killed in northwest Queensland this disaster so far. That figure will rise when the water recedes and graziers can inspect their land. The region has been hit by catastrophic floods before, including recently in 2019.
It was like a car accident. It happened really quickly, whereas this one is more similar to what they call the 74 flood, and it's been very slow and drawn out, and I say it's like someone being on a ventilator or life support.
River gauges are owned by a patchwork of government agencies, including the Bureau of Meteorology. But the Richmond Mayor says they need to be managed and maintained by just one entity.
And you can save a lot of cattle if the gauges are all working. And you save a lot of stress and you save a lot of loss. So gauges are very, very important.
The Weather Bureau told 7.30 two of its automatic gauges on the Flinders River are currently out of service, and a number owned by state and local governments are also out of action. Once the site is accessible and inspections can take place, the Bureau will confirm the extent of the damage.
There is a real challenge in the gauges. I think it's not a straightforward one.
Dr. Pete Follette is an expert on waterways. He says managing the state's flood warning system is extremely complex.
I think it's just the tyranny of distance, our size. They're owned by multiple organisations, a mixture of BOM ones, which are the really high-tech, high-specification. We have state government ones, we have local government ones, water utilities, the odd mining company, and maybe the other private ones.
What could cause a flood gauge to go out of action?
Often the most big challenge one is that if you did get a big pulse go through, a lot of it is really maintenance.
The Queensland government says the gauges it owns were operational during the flood.
My criticism of the Bureau is not of those who work there, it's of the lack of funding that has gone there to upgrade those facilities over a long period of time.
Councils are stretched big time. Like, to have someone who has this as part of their portfolio is, I think, a real challenge. So they need support.
To centralise the system, the federal government says it's in the process of buying back a third of the 3,300 gauges in Queensland and upgrading existing ones at a cost of $236 million over 10 years. But that's little comfort for these graziers.
The working river gauges, they're a lifesaver. They're saving cattle's lives anyway, and sometimes human life when they're working.
Grazier Ashley Gallagher ending that report from Laura Lavelle as seen on 7.30. And you can watch that back as well online at ABC iView too. And coming up a bit later, we'll check in with those Victorian fires too. Now, the civil strife in Iran could affect the prices of some key commodities, including oil, energy and fertilisers. Iran exports about 10% of the world's urea, and any push by President Trump to restrict trade with Iran could strangle the supply and force prices up. Andrew Whitelaw is commodity analyst at episode3.net and says he's more concerned about the price of fertiliser than US tariffs being imposed on Australia due to our trade with Iran.
All we have to do is look back to last June when Israel, the US and Iran were in a little bit of a early stages of a conflict, and then the urea price went absolutely through the roof, and that was off the back of energy prices. Because one of the things we've got to remember is that energy prices are what drive urea pricing. And so when there's that risk of some sort of barriers to the trade in energy, and Iran, you know, controls the Strait of Hormuz, which is about 20% of the world's energy goes through there. If there's a concern that there's going to be restrictions or lack of access, then energy prices go through the roof, and then that flows through to urea. And then, and sort of secondly, like, it's an interesting one, because if you look at the countries who actually trade with Iran, and Donald Trump has said that he'll make companies pay a 25% tariff if they continue to trade with Iran, one of the big traders with Iran is China. So I guess if a 25% tariff is added on to China, then it will be it could be the restarting of that China-US trade war, which was looking like it was getting, you know, fixed. But I think it's an interesting one, because we are in a situation where, you know, Trump has said that he's going to put a tariff on countries that continue to trade with Iran, but it's pretty hard to actually track in real time whether a country is actually trading with another country or not. So it's going to be an interesting time to see what happens there.
They also do a lot of wheat trade with Russia too, don't they? So there may be, you know, we might see tariffs on, more increasing tariffs on Russia.
Yeah, look, again, like Russia and Iran trade are also another nation that trade a lot with Iran. So is Iraq, Pakistan, I believe, as well is another one, and India. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a situation where, forget, if we forget about the task for a second, we just think about the instability and the potential for regime change. The reality is that could have a negative on our urea pricing, because it all depends on how long and how messy it gets over there. If it becomes a nice clean regime change, then things might not change. But if it turns into protracted civil war stroke conflict, then we could see prices spike up, because at the end of the day, they produce about 10% of the world's trade in urea. And countries might start to think, well, actually, I'm not going to buy in urea from Iran because I don't want to get in hit with any tariffs. So it might mean there'll be a de facto sort of end of Iranian urea for a while, whilst other countries compete for other origins other than Iran.
And it's at a time when Australian farmers will be looking around for urea, looking around for fertiliser, as Trump look putting a crop.
Probably looking more for your phosphates at this point for seeding. But at the end of the day, people will be looking to start making a purchasing decision between now and seeding. And we could see, if this conflict rises, increase in prices. Because if we look at our urea price at the moment, it's sort of at the level it was prior to June last year. But then we saw in June the market just absolutely rally because of gas prices going up in the Middle East, but also a lot of plants shutting down. One to keep an eye on, but from a positive point of view, so don't always be negative all the time about markets. If the energy price goes up, if crude oil prices go absolutely gangbusters and gas prices go gangbusters, yes, our fuel for harvesting and seeding will go up, our fertilizers will go up. And generally, when crude oil prices go up, so does corn, wheat, and barley prices and canola.
So, other commodity prices follow.
Other commodity prices follow, especially the grains, because they are substitutable into the energy market.
So we don't do, it shouldn't really be a problem for us to worry about a 25% tariff from Trump on Australian goods, because we just don't do that sort of much trade with the wheat or beef or lamb or barley with Iran.
Well, we do a little bits of grain with Iran, but what I would say is I don't think it's going to be a particularly big issue. Like the volumes we've done, like last year, if we look at the top 10 countries that we trade with, Iran featured in the top 10 of barley in 10th place, probably about 100,000 tons or so, so very, very small volumes. And I don't know how strong this tariff from Trump will be, whether it actually becomes a law or not, and how easy it is for a country to track another country's trade in real time. I wouldn't worry too much about it at the present.
Well, the Supreme Court might determine that those tariffs are actually illegal because they're looking at it now.
Yeah, and that's the situation we're in just now. Is a sort of very fluid environment. In fact, we've been in a very fluid environment since Trump took office. But I think it's definitely a concern, the civil instability in Iran, because it does have a flow-on effect to the rest of the world. So I think we can't ignore it.
The other issue, you mentioned the fuel prices there, and if fuel prices skyrocket and diesel prices go up and people are wanting to put a crop in, so that could be an impost that people weren't expecting too.
Absolutely. And it just depends on how long the conflict goes and how messy it becomes. But again, like I was saying before, it's got negatives and it's got positives. Negatives, higher fuel pricing, higher fertilizer pricing. Positives are potential for higher grain pricing as well. Energy prices and grain prices follow each other with a very strong correlation.
Andrew Whitelaw, commodity analyst at episode3.net, talking to Michael Condon. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 19 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, for the first time, an Australian Red will be up for auction at International Dairy Week, which will be held from this Saturday in Victoria. After decades of use on Australian farms, why is this the breed's first appearance at the event? The heifer for sale will be coming from Hamilton Run, a dairy farm at OB Flat, run by Graham and Michelle Hamilton. And Graham explained to Elsie Adamo a bit about the breed.
My parents made the decision in the early 1960s to move to red breeds. Some dissatisfaction at the time with some of the other opportunities or availabilities, and we've just stuck with them ever since. We have tried other breeds along the way, but we've always returned back to reds.
So why is that? What makes them, you know, superior in your view?
I guess that perhaps the first thing that every dairy farmer comes into contact with firstly is their personality and temperament. So, you know, that's a tick, but that doesn't pay the bills, unfortunately. So then after that it comes down to productivity and stamina and durability, which are things that reduce the hidden costs in running dairy cows. So we've been satisfied with the herd life and the productivity of our cows, but always with a view to it needs to be better.
When it comes to Australian dairy farms, what is the breed of choice generally? Is it Australian Reds, or are they still kind of on the minority?
They are the minority. We'd like to think that they're the third dairy breed in Australia. Holsteins are some 67-odd percent, I think, and Jerseys some 15 or 20%, and crossbreds account for quite a few as well. But then the Australian Reds come in just after that. So they're widely distributed, but not great in numbers.
So why do you think that they haven't become more popular? As you said, your family's been farming them here for, what, over 60 years now. Why haven't they gotten to be one of the most popular?
Possibly people, when they're seeking genetics, in the old days they used to go to bull sales. These days they buy genetics through semen companies, and the availability of the other breeds is much greater. So for those that aren't particularly passionate about breeding, the other breeds are the easy choice. But we think we offer an economic viable alternative, but we're conscious that we need to be improving all the time, constantly.
So we're out on your farm here today, and we're right next to a little pen with a heifer in it that's going to be on its way to be sold at the International Dairy Week coming up in later this month. So what was behind the decision to put her up for auction?
Dairy farming can have a lot of glossy photographs in the various magazines and online that we see, but somehow or other, farmers are practical people. They like to see results in the vat and how cattle are managed. So we think that selling animals and that is a better way of promoting your cattle than glossy adverts. There's room for a necessity for both, but we think this live animals plays a very big part in them proving themselves on other people's farms as well. So we've chosen what we think is our best, because that's the one that will create the best image and will perform to the satisfaction of the buyer and for us, because we get a joy out of it when other people buy those animals and they perform well on their farms too. So I think it's just part of promotion, part of proving the worth of your cattle, and being part of a group of breeders who are all passionate about what we do.
So why hasn't this happened before? Why now?
Over the years, the sale has been run by various promoters. For the last few years, it's been Sexing Technologies, ST Genetics, as they're often called. And, you know, they've probably got a broader view of dairying than perhaps some of the previous promoters, I don't know. But, yeah, we've got to thank ST Genetics for including her in the sale. And also, Dairy Week is run by a fellow called Declan Patton, and he also was enthusiastic about including this breed. So we've taken the opportunity and tried to put up an animal that meets their criteria, and they've accepted her because they screen the animals that go in to keep the ranking of the sale, you know, first class. And so we've apparently met those screening criteria.
Why have you chosen this particular animal? What makes her special?
The passion of breeding is varies from every farmer or breeder. And one of the things that I'm quite convinced on is the value of cow families. And this one comes from the Matilda family, and they've got a long history. Not just being around long, but outperforming their peers over that time. So that consistency and performance are what goes together, and so that's why she was chosen. She's got some good breeding value numbers. That's a whole lot of numbers that are created to to rank the worth of animals in the national dairy herd, and she's got some good statistics there as well.
Do you feel any pressure being the first one showing an Australian red at this event?
There's always some inner doubts that sort of crop up, but no, I think that all we can do in this life is just do our best, and that's what we're doing.
Graham Hamilton from Hamilton Run Dairy Farm, speaking with Elsie Adamo. Brooke Nindorf with you. Let's find out what's been happening in the weather. We're going to head to the Bureau now, and Daniel Sherwin-Simpson joins us. Good afternoon, Daniel.
Good afternoon, Brooke.
What's been happening across the state?
Yeah, so it's been a fairly settled day across the state. There is a little bit of cloud out over the west and also across the tip of the peninsulas. Probably seen a very light shower coming through Kangaroo Island right now in some spots. Having a look at the radar, there's a tiny bit on there, but it's not going to be a whole lot. We could see just that kind of tiny light shower, not really much of significance down in the southeast as we move into the afternoon. But for everyone else, it's looking like a relatively dry day for the rest of the day. As we move into tomorrow, we're going to start to see a pretty fresh southerly airstream establish across the state. And just because of those fresher winds pushing in off the coast, we could start to pick up a few showers with anywhere that sort of has a slightly southward-facing coast. But generally, through the southeast and also down the back of the lofty ranges, you could pick up a couple of showers tomorrow. Those will ease off in the afternoon, but we could see a slight repeat again on Friday, although less significant totals. That being said, though, the totals on Thursday won't be anything too significant either. As we move into Saturday, more settled conditions across the state. Realistically, over the next couple of days, things stay very samey in terms of weather. We do see the temperatures drop down a bit tomorrow with that stronger southerly airstream that hangs around through Friday. Then we see some warmer temperatures developing across the weekend and into early next week. But really, there's not too much of significance in terms of weather, and as I mentioned, that in terms of rainfall as well. By the time we get out to Sunday, it'll generally be less than 2 millimetres across coastal districts. If you're in the far north, you're looking at completely dry conditions. You possibly could see some totals more like 2 to 5 millimetres about some of those windward coasts and across the lofty ranges, but not looking at much in terms of rainfall, unfortunately, Brooke, if that's what you're hanging out for. But I guess the one good news story is, even though it is going to be mostly dry, we're not looking at any sort of heat wave conditions coming through. As I mentioned, there is a bit of warmth at times on Sunday and into Monday, but nothing too severe in terms of weather is, I guess, the plus side looking ahead.
Yeah, Danielle, I think, any rain this sort of time of year for a bit of subsoil moisture heading into seeding is always welcome. But also, you know, things like Tunarama and all that coming up, they don't want too much of that kind of weather. They'd like some nice warm weather for the weekend, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think for some of the events coming up, yeah, plenty of warm, sunny days, noting the tour down under through the Adelaide area as well. I think the weather should be pretty all right for them. So I think it's good event weather, but probably not good rainfall weather, if that's what you're after, at least.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Daniel, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today. Have a good afternoon.
Cheers, you too, Brooke.
That was Daniel Sherwin-Simpson from the Bureau of Meteorology. And let's head to the Western Inlands now. For the Upper Western, mostly sunny with a slight chance of a shower in the northeast in the afternoon. A near zero chance of rain elsewhere. The chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the afternoon and the evening. Wind southeast to southwesterly 20 to 30 kilometres per hour. Turning west to southwesterly in the early afternoon. Then turning south to southwesterly 25 to 40 k's per hour in the late afternoon. Overnight temperatures falling to 23 to 28, with daytime temperatures reaching 37 to 43. And then to the lower western, sunny with wind south to southwesterly 15 to 25 kilometres per hour, becoming southwesterly 25 to 40 kilometres per hour in the morning, and overnight temperatures falling to between 16 and 21, with daytime temperatures reaching 32 to 39. Brooke Nindorf with you today. It's 29 minutes past 12.
Each weekday at noon, tune into the Country Hour.
European breeds thrown in the mix, some Simmental and the odd Black Angus. It's a bit of a fruit salad.
The Country Hour.
Food of the gods.
Tune in weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Thanks for joining me today on this Wednesday afternoon. As I said just before, Brooke Neindorf with you today and for the rest of this week. Cassie Huff will be back with you next week. But coming up, in one of the most remote parts of New South Wales, a desert has been turned into an oasis.
The great thrills of the last couple of months has been able to go and do aerial surveys over, I think, one of the most incredible wetlands that we've got in the country.
We'll hear more on that very shortly and also find out why it is so significant, but pretty cool work that they're doing there. But before that, let's get the latest from the newsroom, and we're joined by Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Brooke. In the news this afternoon, Palestinian-Australian author Randa Abdul-Fattah says her lawyers are preparing to launch defamation proceedings against the Premier, Peter Malinauskas, after his public commentary about her scheduled appearance at Adelaide Writers' Week. In a social media post, Abdul-Fattah said her lawyers had issued a concerns notice under the Defamation Act. She's described the Premier's commentary as a vicious personal assault on her. The state's peak body for housing is set to close after 5 years without government funding. While Shelter SA does not directly provide accommodation, the group works on policy, research and advocacy to improve the housing system. And the state government will invest more than $500,000 with the City of Port Augusta to improve safety in the city's CBD and residential public spaces. The government and the council will each provide $271,000 towards the second stage of the council's Safer Spaces program. It will include expanding CCTV coverage, public Wi-Fi charging stations, and supporting small business operators to improve shopfront safety. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Matt. Matt Coleman in the newsroom. Now let's go to Victoria again now, and it is going to be a long road ahead for fruit growers who have lost their permanent plantings in those Victorian fires. Michael Crisera is a Grower Services Manager with Fruit Growers Victoria, and Angus Verley spoke with him about the fruit-growing regions that have been impacted by the fire.
Yeah, so two regions in particular have been impacted. Obviously Harcourt, there is some apple orchards and also the Coolstore that's been impacted, and then also the Yarrawea, sort of in south of Cobham, a grass fire has also impacted some of the stone fruit and cherry growers in that region.
And Michael, it probably just highlights how badly Victoria has been hit by fires that I think a lot of people might not even be aware of. That Cobram fire, it may have been lost in the thick of things.
Yeah, I think so. I think, people don't realise what sort of... It was quite a large grass fire that really got out of control quite quickly with, obviously, the conditions we had. And, there's been some damage to stone fruit orchards up that way and potentially, I think, a cherry orchard as well.
And obviously different for different fruit, but where are we at in the growing season? Have there been crops that were just about to be harvested that have been lost?
Yeah, well, stone fruit, sort of, that's a peak time at this time of year for stone fruit in that Cobram Yarrawea area. And then also Harcourt, it's not sort of that close to harvest. It's sort of mid-growing period and getting close for gala apples, but I suspect the majority of the fruit impacted at Harcourt would have been pink lady apples, which we don't harvest for a while. But yeah, there's definitely been some work in getting those trees to where they are now, and to have them lost like this. And an issue with permanent plantings is when you get impacted by bushfires, it can take anywhere between 3 and 5 years to get those trees back into full production. That's whether you cut them back and get them to grow again, or whether you totally remove it and replant.
Okay, so still assessments to be done, but some of those trees, there might be hope for them?
Yeah, potentially, yeah. So unfortunately, there's been some historical events in other regions through that black summer fires in 2019, 2020 up at Batlow and Lenswood, where they've had bushfire impacted orchards. And so there's been some findings and sort of some studies done on the impact of the different types of fires. So there are some learnings there that the growers, if they need to look at some resources, there's definitely some resources online from Batlow and Lenswood if they have a look at some of the bushfire impacts online. So it just really depends on what type of damage they got, whether it's radiated heat or whether the fire's ripped through the farm.
And I imagine, Michael, for those orchards that are irrigated, that'll be the other problem, that the irrigation systems would be ruined as well.
Correct. And that's sort of the key thing we've found with a lot of the growers in Harcourt especially, looking to try and I think they haven't had power since Friday, so they're trying to get in generators to get their pumps going to look after the crop that's not been affected, you know. And I imagine that's the case in Cobram and Yarrawea as well, you know, just making sure that the irrigation hasn't been impacted immediately near the tree. So there'll be a lot of work going in there at the moment to try and get that irrigation repaired.
Okay, so it's going, as you said, going to be a long road ahead.
Correct, yeah, it will be a long road ahead. Look, the thing we encourage, get in there, try and fix what you've got, you know, what crop you've got left, and then we'll look at assessments. You know, towards the end of this week, we'll probably get a better picture of the total amount of trees and hectares being impacted, but we're still sort of collating that. You know, we're mindful as well. People are still, trying to come to grips with what's happened and trying to get themselves immediate sort of support. But yeah, I think there's going to be some longer term support needed for these guys to get them back up. You know, to be without production for a large amount of hectares, even a small amount of hectares, it can take quite a long time and really impact these guys quite badly, you know, financially.
Michael Crosiero, Growers Services Manager with Fruit Growers Victoria, speaking with Angus Verley. Now, it is going to be a long road to recovery, as we just heard there, for the communities affected by bushfires. In the Strathbogies Ranges, the little township of Ruffey, which is home to just under 200 residents, has been hit pretty hard, with many people losing their homes. The last few days, there has been a mission to distribute hay to the livestock, which survived. Now, Annie Brown spoke to a few of the residents of Ruffey from the centre of town, where hay was being dropped off.
Hi, I'm Colleen Fulinetto. I'm a fifth generation of Ruffey. We have property just out in the township here. We didn't have any stock, we've lost fencing, etc. Our little house that no one was there to defend and we didn't expect it to be has been just something that survived for no rhyme or reason. It should have gone, it didn't. So we're very, very lucky. I am just here as someone working with Elders, Nutrien and Rodwells around the hay coordination for up here at Ruffey. And we're getting our main depot down in Longwood and getting volunteers driving their trucks coming up and just doing circles and circles of what is a really difficult ride up the Longwood Ruffey road. And for the most hardened, it's really difficult. But how do you prepare to see what we're going to see? But my family members, uncles and aunties and very dear friends that have lost their homes, it just puts life into perspective that we don't fully appreciate how quickly fire will move. And we all talk about, you know, what, every 10 years there'll be a cycle of fire. This is like nothing ever before. So how do you prepare for it? But I do think that we can learn from it and always tweak things. And I think we've got a lot of opportunity here from this tragedy to not lose the learnings to ensure that let's make it two generations that it might skip and not have another generation have to have this trauma. But I think really the locals that are going like ever-ready batteries, I think should be just so held so highly. But batteries don't last forever and we need to make sure we've got, you know, the charge is there to come in and ensure that the confidence is there that others can take the reins for a bit and people can have a bit of a rest. This is a long recovery. We will need a lot more hay and we will need a lot more goodwill, a lot more dog food. That seems to be a great donation that people are giving, dog food.
What's it been like sitting here? So you're sort of at like a little man-made depot, right, for people to come pick up hay and take it out to their properties. What's it been like sort of sitting here and seeing people come through?
It's been pretty hard when you're related to most of the people and not haven't seen them for the first time since the fire. So they're coming in and you're just like, all right, I've got this hat on at the moment. But you have to hug them and you have to hold them and they're holding you and you're like, oh, I really should be writing something down. This is my job to be coordinating, but what do you do? So for me, it's been extremely emotional, but I think it's been an element of trust to have some local faces supporting the local people and local businesses being at the forefront of that as well as the volunteers.
Yeah, Joel Craven, been born in Euroa, bred in Euroa, so I work over at Murchison on a family farm, and then yeah, mum and dad have country in Crichton's Creek, and then yeah, dad's whole family was up from Terrip, Ruffey, so dad knows it like the back of his hand. I don't, I'm sort of learning. Just, I know the locals, know the people. It's devastating to see the places you sort of knew when you were kids running around.
Has your family lost property or, you know, assets, stuff like that?
Nah, so we were one of the lucky ones. Mum and we were sort of fighting two houses at once. So my brother and his partner come very, very close to that one on the Mansfield Road. And then mum and dad's, yeah, yesterday we were pretty nervous. If it was going to come over that flank, we knew, yeah, she's on. So, but yeah, very extremely lucky, luckier than other people, unfortunately.
And tell us about what you've been up to today. You've got your trailer and your Land Cruiser. It's filled to the brim with hay.
Ah, oh, sitting at home, sort of seeing it all around you. Yeah, it kills you sitting there, seeing and hearing about it. And yeah, you don't want to be a sticky nose, but you don't, that doesn't come through your head when you think of it. You want to hop in, help out, just anything you can. Hook up, load as many as you can. You get more and more each time you come back for a load. And yeah, just seeing the places you know and people you know, like, you go up to them and you don't even want to say, how are you going? Like, you don't know how to greet them. Just seeing the looks on their face and the impression, you're just like, far out. It's hitting home a bit. That's just the worst part. Just locally, not just, yeah, can't sit still, let alone. So I couldn't sit still seeing everything around us.
Well, Joel, thanks for having a chat with us. There's another truck coming in with an excavator on the back of it, just watching it come around the corner.
Yeah, that's my brother, actually.
There you go. You're all out helping.
Yeah, we're all out helping, all hands on deck. Yeah, just keep your head up high. That's all you can do. Sort of, you see the greedy, like you hear the greedy people, but you sort of can't even think of that. You're here to help out. You're not here to take money or take a pat on the back. You don't need appreciation. You just got to help out where you can.
Joel Craven speaking with Annie Brown and in the township of Ruffey. And you also heard from Colleen Furlanetto before that as well. Now, just sticking with the fires there in Victoria, Patrick Wallach Farmer has criticised the management of public land to reduce the impact of bushfires after a fire in the Wiperfield National Park burnt almost 60,000 hectares. Simon Griggs says there is no fuel reduction burning done in the park, meaning large-scale fires are inevitable. And Angus Verley is speaking with him here.
Yeah, well, last Friday there was a lightning strike that we think that started at right in the northwest corner of the Big Desert, which at Bowinka, and that fire got hold and it just went like crazy, as we all know the conditions on Friday. And it was heading in a southerly direction with a strong north wind, so we weren't too worried, but when the wind changed, that's when it took out most of the Pine Plains part of Wiperfeld National Park, and also it came into my property and also my neighbour's property.
Okay, so the fire is largely contained to scrub, but it has gone onto private property as well.
Certainly came into private property, yep. I was very fortunate that it came into the paddock where I had lentils, so it didn't burn that well. They were able to contain it. It took out 3 or 4 k's of fencing and trees that were in the paddock. And we're still monitoring it now because those trees are still hot. Yeah, very, very, very lucky, and nothing compared to what's been happening in other areas, that's for sure.
And that's the thing. Usually a fire of that scale would be making headlines, but as you say, with what's happened in other parts of Victoria, that hasn't been the case.
No, and it's devastating, you know, not on my property, but Pine Plains, you know, with it's been part of the local history and entertainment and valued for the close community for, you know, forever. Once upon a time, my cousins used to lease that country. They had cattle and sheep out there, and there was always fires out there, but they were always contained. They were always little fires, little grass fires, and they were always able to be contained, whereas now they just lock it up for 10 years, and then every 10 years it just burns to the ground, and it's just devastating what's happened this time because it's taken probably 80% of the park and all the big trees, you know, the balar and the box and the river gums and, you know, all the wildlife, the mallee fowl, the kangaroos, the habitat for the birds, it's just all gone, and it's just ridiculous. It's a joke. It's just decimated the place, and it's just so sad.
Now, you talked about the park now being locked up. Is there any planned burning being done, or when was the last time there was planned burning in the park?
Zero. No, it's absolutely zero. There is no fire prevention in the park. The state forest state forest have prevention measures. They do they chain around the edge of private property, and it does a fantastic job. But once you get into national park, there is zero fire prevention.
Patch Wallach Farmer Simon Griggs speaking with Angus Furley. Now, are you spraying for summer weeds at the moment? Primary producers are being reminded to take extra care when spraying to prevent spray drift. And officers from PIRZA will be undertaking compliance checks once again to make sure there are no poor spraying practices being done. Biosecurity Manager for Rural Chemical Operations with PIRZA, Michael McManus, says everyone needs to be really careful this time of year.
What we've seen in previous summer periods is that with a lot of increased spraying to control soil moisture levels and control the weeds, that we see damage to horticulture and particularly grapevines at this time of year. We get small droplets moving off site in the wrong weather conditions and out there affecting grapevines and horticulture, and we don't want that damage. It's really important we avoid that damage to our other parts of our primary industries.
Is it frustrating that that is still happening?
It is frustrating that we still see it, particularly in those wetter years when a lot of spraying gets done for summer weeds. But we know farmers are getting really well educated on how to improve their spraying practices, and most are actually out there doing that. They've attended training courses and they're going to, you know, significant lengths to now understand about hazardous weather conditions and avoiding those periods and getting the droplet sizes right. But we still see damage because it only takes a small amount of fine droplets to move off site to cause damage.
PIRZA really ramped up their checks on spraying recently and undertaking compliance activities on property. Do you think that has helped with people doing the right thing as well?
Absolutely. I think the presence of our compliance officers out in the field certainly helps. They've also worked with the producers a lot, providing education when they do meet them or dealing with people who are perhaps not as compliant as they should be. So I certainly think that that's helped, and knowing that they're out there and could check at any time and they'll be out inspecting people as they're doing their spraying is certainly valuable.
What would be, I guess, your key points for producers when it comes to spraying?
Probably two key points, really. So spray drift damage can really only occur if the fine droplets move off-site. And so the two parts are make sure you're not producing fine droplets by slowing down your speed, keeping your boom height low, and using the right droplet size out of your machinery. So that's the first key point. And the second one is not spraying in conditions when the spray can move off-site. So that's really those hazardous inversion conditions that occur most nights across summer from 1 to 2 hours before sunset and 1 to 2 hours after sunrise. So avoid spraying in those conditions and check the Mesonet, because that'll give you really accurate advice on if there is a hazardous inversion.
Because these drops can travel a long way, can't they?
Well, that's right. They certainly can travel, you know, tens of kilometres in some situations. So it's not just neighbour to neighbour that people should be worried about. You know, if you're spraying in the wrong conditions, it can travel 10, 20, even 50 kilometres in a bad hazardous inversion if the fine droplets get up there. So, yeah, you certainly need to be worried not just about your neighbouring properties, but about people further away as well.
Biosecurity Manager for Rural Chemical Operations with PIRZA, Michael McManus. Now, in one of the most remote parts of New South Wales, a desert has been turned into an oasis. Water from historic floods in southwest Queensland early last year have flown down the Bulloo River into the Bulloo Overflow and the Karripundi Swamp. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event which ecologists have been able to witness firsthand since the government purchased the Nuriara Station about 5 years ago and turned it into a national park. University of New South Wales river ecologist Professor Richard Kingsford says it's an amazing sight to see.
The great thrills of the last couple of months has been able to go and do aerial surveys over, I think, one of the most incredible wetlands that we've got in the country. And we know it's big, but when you've actually got to survey it from a light aircraft and it takes you hours to go back and forth, you just realise just what an amazing natural phenomenon this is, and a result of floods that came through in March.
What do the results show from your bird survey?
Well, as you can imagine, it takes a while to transcribe all the survey count data, and we're counting into little tape recorders as we go. But we estimate there was probably 200,000 to 300,000 water birds there, maybe even more than that. And we think more than 30 species. We have thousands of things like freckled duck, which are a rare species, but over 100,000 grey teal and 70,000 pink-eared duck, and And even the swans were breeding there and swamp hens were breeding. I've never seen so many swamp hens in one place. And one of the sort of enigmas of water birds are these black-tailed native hens, which were all also there in their tens of thousands. And so just an incredible sight to see.
How exciting was it for you to see this?
Yeah, look, it's fantastic. I love being able to see what's happening. I mean, we're flying at 50 metres above the water with tape recorders being like race callers and identifying and estimating the numbers of birds. So you're busy, but you're also able to take in this magnificent expanse of water. And then the context of sort of knowing that this is an incredibly healthy system and it's just going through the natural rhythms that it's been doing since tens of thousands of years. It's just also that belief about what we can do and how we can protect some of these magnificent systems.
How long do you expect water to remain there?
It's a good question. I have a bit of trouble sort of thinking how long that'll be because it's incredibly shallow expanse of water. But even so, we could see that, you know, only see some of the tops of the fence line. So it's a fair bit of depth there. So I'd imagine it's going to stay well into the new year. But it's obviously got to go through a very hot, dry time out in that part of the world. And so there'll be a lot of evaporation. And that's also interesting because as that area dries out, it becomes even more productive because all those invertebrates and fish that are in the water are going to be available to a whole range of different water birds. And so you'll see these sort of interesting cycles that happen within a cycle as it floods and dries. And I'd expect, you know, there'll be incredible action in terms of what's happening there well until it dries. And then, of course, when it dries, it's sort of got all of this moisture. And so you get all the plants and animals and woodland birds and all of those and the small mammals will be able to take advantage of that high productivity that's in the system.
Malian Yapa man Mark Sutton has welcomed the arrival of water.
Kerriapundi Swamp is this wonderful inland sea that is currently, I think, about 30 kilometres wide by about 30 kilometres long because of all of the water that has come into that system from the north, from up in Queensland, down the Bulloo River and into Kerriapundi Swamp.
It's a slow system?
It is a slow system. It takes a very long time to fill. I often describe it as being a little bit similar to Lake Eyre, Cuddy Thunder, which when it fills, you know, it can take literally months for that water to make its way down through those creeks and systems to ultimately fill Lake Eyre, and I would imagine that it has taken the same amount of time for Kerriapundi Swamp to become so full.
What's its significance to the Malian Yapa people?
Well, as semi-arid desert people, any large body of water is obviously pretty important to us. Because this is a semi-arid desert landscape, big bodies of water are pretty rare. They're not found much in the landscape anymore, not like how they used to be, certainly. So obviously we've got Menindee Lakes down to the southeast of Broken Hill, and most of those ephemeral lake systems traversing all throughout northwestern New South Wales don't fill that often, or when they fill, the water doesn't last very long because of evaporation loss and soakage into the ground. So to have a system that is that big, full of water, as I said, it's a once-in-a-lifetime event. The Malian Yapa peoples, including our native title group, have been up there a couple of times in recent months, particularly since it was purchased from Bill by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and we've been up there in that landscaping, in that landscape, celebrating the arrival of such a large body of water, and also as local Aboriginal people, being able to just visit that particular area, because obviously now that it's owned by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, opportunities for us as local Aboriginal people to visit those landscapes might become more regular.
What does it mean to you to see this water, or the Malian Yapa people to see this water? What does it mean culturally for you?
It means that our totem species are being replenished. in our local tribal groups, we have semi-arid desert species like fish, of course, like ducks. My particular totem is the bony brim, or nyamba in language. And that particular species of fish sits in the sand, often for many years, waiting for a deluge of decent rain. Then once that water arrives, either flowing down through systems or from the skies, those eggs hatch, and within weeks those previous dry lakes can suddenly be full of fish. And people always wondered, well, how could that be if there's no system feeding those particular lakes? But of course they've been waiting in the sand all along, just waiting for the water.
5 years ago, the New South Wales government purchased Nuriara Station, and Ranger Emma McLean says they've been recording a lot of untouched Indigenous artefacts.
This place is so incredibly rich in Aboriginal cultural heritage. Pretty much, you know, everywhere you walk, especially once you get off the tracks, everywhere you walk, it's just all over the place. And what it shows is such a long and important and rich history of humans living on this site. Even, you know, we know that the landscape was quite different. Even back as, you know, sort of 12,000 years ago, there would have been a lot more water here. And even more recently, it's definitely an important place. Just the artefacts show us that it's an important place for Aboriginal people.
These sites where, I guess, artefacts have been discovered show that they haven't really been disturbed, that it's untouched.
Yeah, a lot of the time. Yeah, there's some really, really fascinating and important examples of things like hearths, you know, which are ancient cooking fires where people would cook their food, and even stone artefacts, stone rings, ceremonial rings, and all sorts of things like that.
New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service Ranger Emma McLean speaking to Catherine Spackman. And you can read more of this story online at abc.net.au/rural. Let's find out what happened now at the Dublin markets yesterday. And Elsie Adamo has those numbers. Hi, Elsie.
Good afternoon, Brooke. Another modest yarding was presented as agents offered 3,700 lambs and 750 sheep. Quality was fair to good, with competition from the usual trade and processor buyers returning a mostly firm to dearer trend. Feeders and restockers were also active across the yarding. The limited number of sheep sold to extreme competition. New season crossbred light stores ranged from $160 to $180, as stores sold from $180 to $210 per head. Crossbred trade lambs sold from $200 to $250. Heavy trades range from $250 to $280, with older heavyweights selling from $280 to $340 per head. Merino light stores sold from $80 to $90, with stores fetching $120 to $180. Trade weights range from $180 to $250, as heavy trades sold from $250 to $285 per head. Heavy sheep sold from $230 to $280. Trade weights range from $180 to $250, with light sheep fetching $100 to $180 per head. Meanwhile, in the cattle market, a fair to average quality yarding of 120 live weight cattle met good competition from the usual field of trade and processor buyers, feeders and restockers, with prices generally firm on recent sales. Feelers sold from 460 to 502 cents. Trade steers range from 430 to 450 cents, with heifers fetching 420 to 440 cents per kilogram. Restocker steers range from 420 to 460 cents, with heifers selling from 390 to 410 cents per kilogram. Feeder steers sold from 430 to 450 cents, as heifers range from 370 to 420 cents per kilogram. Heavy steers sold from 380 to 430 cents, with heifers fetching 360 to 370 cents per kilogram. Heavy cows range from 320 to 350 cents, with light cows fetching 250 to 270 cents per kilogram. This has been Elsie Adamo reading a report prepared by John Traeger for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks very much, Elsie Adamo, with those numbers. And we haven't had the Southeast market come through yet, so haven't got those numbers for you today. That's all we've got time for on the Country Hour today. Make sure you jump online. You can read more and keep up to date with those fires in Victoria and also those floods in Queensland. There's some pretty spectacular photos, pretty heartbreaking photos as well coming through. But you can jump online to abc.net.au/rural to keep up with the latest. I'll be back with it at the same time tomorrow. It's coming up to news time. It's 1 o'clock.
The ABC Listen app lets you take ABC Radio with you wherever you go. At home, in the gym, up a ladder, on the road,
interstate,
out of space. Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.